in Egypt and Mesopotamia, through a series of quasi-fictional treaties with local and powerless chiefs, it controlled the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Suez Canal, as well as most of the intervening landmass between the Mediterranean and India. France, on the other hand, seemed fated to hover over the Orient, descending once in a while to carry out schemes that repeated de Lesseps' success with the canal. For the most part, these schemes were railroad projects, such as the one planned across more or less British territory, the Syrian-Mesopotamian line. In addition, France saw itself as the protector of Christian minorities, Maronites, Chaldeans, Nestorians. Yet together, Britain and France were agreed in principle on the necessity, when the time came, for the partition of Asiatic Turkey. Both before and during World War I, secret diplomacy was bent on carving up the Near Orient first into spheres of influence, then into mandated or occupied territories. In France, much of the expansionist sentiment formed during the heyday of the geographical movement focused itself on plans to partition Asiatic Turkey, so much so that in Paris in 1914, a spectacular press campaign was launched to this end. In England, numerous committees were empowered to study and recommend policy on the best ways of dividing up the Orient. Out of such commissions as the Bunsen Committee would come the joint Anglo-French teams, of which the most famous was the one headed by Mark Sykes and Georges Picot. Equitable division of geographical space was the rule of these plans, which were deliberate attempts also at calming Anglo-French rivalry. For, as Sykes put it in a memorandum, "It was clear that an Arab rising was sooner or later to take place, and that the French and ourselves ought to be on better terms if the rising was not to be a curse instead of a blessing." The animosities remained, and to them was added the irritant provided by the Wilsonian Program for National Self-Determination, which, as Sykes himself was to note, seemed to invalidate the whole skeleton of colonial and partitionary schemes arrived at jointly between the powers. It would be out of place here to discuss the entire labyrinthine and deeply controversial history of the Near Orient in the early 20th century, as its fate was being decided between the powers, the native dynasties, the various nationalist parties and movements, the Zionists. What matters more immediately is the peculiar epistemological framework through which the Orient was seen and out of which the powers acted. For despite their differences, the British and the French saw the Orient as a geographical and cultural, political, demographical, sociological, and historical entity over whose destiny they believed themselves to have traditional entitlement. The Orient to them was no sudden discovery, no mere historical accident, but an area to the east of Europe whose principal worth was uniformly defined in terms of Europe, more particularly in terms specifically claiming for Europe, European science, scholarship, understanding, and administration, the credit for having made the Orient what it was now. And this had been the achievement, inadvertent or not is beside the point, of modern Orientalism. There were two principal methods by which Orientalism delivered the Orient to the West in the early 20th century. One was by means of the disseminative capacities of modern learning, its diffusive apparatus in the learned professions, the universities, the professional societies, the explorational and geographical organizations, the publishing industry. All these, as we have seen, built upon the prestigious authority of the pioneering scholars, travelers, and poets, whose cumulative vision had shaped a quintessential Orient. The doctrinal, or doxological, manifestation of such an Orient is what I have been calling here latent Orientalism. So far as anyone wishing to make a statement of any consequence about the Orient was concerned, latent Orientalism supplied him with an enunciative capacity that could be used, or rather mobilized, and turned into sensible discourse for the concrete occasion at hand. Thus, When Balfour spoke about the Oriental to the House of Commons in 1910, he must surely have had in mind those enunciative capacities in the current and acceptably rational language of his time, by which something called an Oriental could be named and talked about without danger of too much obscurity. But like all enunciative capacities and the discourses they enable, latent Orientalism was profoundly conservative, dedicated, that is, to its self-preservation. Transmitted from one generation to another, it was a part of the culture, as much a language about a part of reality as geometry or physics. Orientalism staked its existence not upon its openness, its receptivity to the Orient, but rather on its internal, repetitious consistency about its constitutive will to power over the Orient. In such a way, Orientalism was able to survive revolutions, world wars, and the literal dismemberment of empires. The second method by which Orientalism delivered the Orient to the West was the result of an important convergence. For decades, the Orientalists had spoken about the Orient. They had translated texts. They had explained civilizations, religions, dynasties, cultures, mentalities, as academic objects, screened off from Europe by virtue of their inimitable foreignness. The Orientalist was an expert, like Renan or Lane, whose job in society was to interpret the Orient for his compatriots. The relation between Orientalist and Orient was essentially hermeneutical. Standing before a distant, barely intelligible civilization or cultural monument, the Orientalist scholar reduced the obscurity by translating, sympathetically portraying, inwardly grasping the hard-to-reach object. Yet the Orientalist remained outside the Orient, which, however much it was made to appear intelligible, remained beyond the Occident. This cultural, temporal, and geographical distance was expressed in metaphors of depth, secrecy, and sexual promise. Phrases like, the veils of an Eastern bride, or the inscrutable Orient, passed into the common language. Yet the distance between Orient and Occident was, almost paradoxically, in the process of being reduced throughout the 19th century. As the commercial, political, and other existential encounters between East and West increased, in ways we have been discussing all along, a tension developed between the dogmas of latent Orientalism with its support in studies of the classical Orient and the descriptions of a present, modern, manifest Orient articulated by travelers, pilgrims, statesmen, and the like. At some moment impossible to determine precisely, the tension caused a convergence of the two types of Orientalism. Probably, and this is only a speculation, the convergence occurred when Orientalists, beginning with Sacy, undertook to advise governments on what the modern Orient was all about. Here, the role of the specially trained and equipped expert took on an added dimension. The Orientalist could be regarded as the special agent of Western power as it attempted policy vis-à-vis the Orient. Every learned and not-so-learned European traveler in the Orient felt himself to be a representative Westerner who had gotten beneath the films of obscurity. This is obviously true of Burton, Lane, Doughty, Flaubert, and the other major figures I have been discussing. The discoveries of Westerners about the manifest and modern Orient acquired a pressing urgency as Western territorial acquisition in the Orient increased. Thus, what the scholarly Orientalist defined as the essential Orient was sometimes contradicted, but in many cases was confirmed when the Orient became an actual administrative obligation. Certainly, Cromer's theories about the Oriental, theories acquired from the traditional Orientalist archive, were vindicated plentifully as he ruled millions of Orientals in actual fact. This was no less true of the French experience in Syria, North Africa, and elsewhere in the French colonies, such as they were. But at no time did the convergence between latent Orientalist doctrine and manifest Orientalist experience occur more dramatically than when, as a result of World War I, Asiatic Turkey was being surveyed by Britain and France for its dismemberment. There, laid out on an operating table for surgery, was the sick man of Europe, revealed in all his weakness, characteristics, and topographical outline. The Orientalist, with his special knowledge, played an inestimably important part in this surgery. Already there had been intimations of his crucial role as a kind of secret agent inside the Orient when the British scholar Edward Henry Palmer was sent to the Sinai in 1882 to gauge anti-British sentiment and its possible enlistment on behalf of the Arabi revolt. Palmer was killed in the process, but he was only the most unsuccessful of the many who performed similar services for the Empire, now a serious and exacting business entrusted in part to the regional expert. Not for nothing was another Orientalist, D.G. Hogarth, author of the famous account of the exploration of Arabia, aptly titled The Penetration of Arabia, 1904, made the head of the Arab Bureau in Cairo during World War I. And neither was it by accident that men and women like Gertrude Bell, T.E. Lawrence, and St. John Filby, Oriental experts all, posted to the Orient as agents of empire, friends of the Orient, formulators of policy alternatives because of their intimate and expert knowledge of the Orient and of Orientals. They formed a band, as Lawrence called it once, bound together by contradictory notions and personal similarities, great individuality, sympathy and intuitive identification with the Orient, a jealously preserved sense of personal mission in the Orient, cultivated eccentricity, a final disapproval of the Orient. For them, all the Orient was their direct, peculiar experience of it. In them, Orientalism and an effective praxis for handling the Orient received their final European form, before the Empire disappeared and passed its legacy to other candidates for the role of dominant power. Such individualists as these were not academics. We shall soon see that they were the beneficiaries of the academic study of the Orient, without in any sense belonging to the official and professional company of Orientalist scholars. Their role, however, was not to scant academic Orientalism, nor to subvert it, but rather to make it effective. In their genealogy were people like Lane and Burton, as much for their encyclopedic autodidacticism as for the accurate, the quasi-scholarly knowledge of the Orient they had obviously deployed when dealing with or writing about Orientals. For the curricular study of the Orient, they substituted a sort of elaboration of latent Orientalism, which was easily available to them in the imperial culture of their epoch. Their scholarly frame of reference, such as it was fashioned by people like William Muir, Anthony Bevan, D.S. Margoliouth, Charles Lyell, E.G. Brown, R.A. Nicholson, Guy Lestrange, E.D. Ross, and Thomas Arnold, who also followed directly in the line of descent from Lane. Their imaginative perspectives were provided principally by their illustrious contemporary Rudyard Kipling, who had sung so memorably of holding dominion over palm and pine. The difference between Britain and France in such matters was perfectly consistent with the history of each nation in the Orient. The British were there. The French lamented the loss of India and the intervening territories. By the end of the century, Syria had become the main focus of French activity, but even there it was a matter of common consensus that the French could not match the British either in quality of personnel or in degree of political influence. The Anglo-French competition over the Ottoman spoils was felt even on the field of battle in the Hejaz, in Syria, in Mesopotamia, but in all these places, as astute men like Edmond Bremont noted, the French Orientalists and local experts were outclassed in brilliance and tactical maneuvering by their British counterparts. Except for an occasional genius like Louis Massignon, There were no French Lawrences or Sykeses or Bells. But there were determined imperialists like Étienne Flandin and Franklin Bouillon. Lecturing to the Paris Alliance Française in 1913, the Comte de Cressati, a vociferous imperialist, proclaimed Syria as France's own Orient, the site of French political, moral, and economic interests. Interests, he added, that had to be defended during this âge des envahissants impérialistes. And yet, Cressati noted that even with French commercial and industrial firms in the Orient, with by far the largest number of native students enrolled in French schools, France was invariably being pushed around in the Orient, threatened not only by Britain, but by Austria, Germany, and Russia. If France was to continue to prevent le retour de l'Islam, it had better take hold of the Orient. This was an argument proposed by Cressati and seconded by Senator Paul Dumay. These views were repeated on numerous occasions, and indeed France did well by itself in North Africa and in Syria after World War I, but the special, concrete management of emerging Oriental populations and theoretically independent territories with which the British always credited themselves was something the French felt had eluded them. Ultimately, perhaps, the difference one always feels between modern British and modern French Orientalism is a stylistic one. The import of the generalizations about Orient and Orientals, the sense of distinction preserved between Orient and Occident, the desirability of Occidental dominance over the Orient, all these are the same in both traditions. For of the many elements making up what we customarily call expertise, style, which is the result of specific worldly circumstances being molded by tradition, institutions, will, and intelligence into formal articulation, is one of the most manifest. It is to this determinant, to this perceptible and modernized refinement in early 20th century Orientalism in Britain and France that we must now turn. 2. Style, expertise, vision. Orientalism's worldliness. As he appears in several poems, in novels like Kim, and in too many catchphrases to be an ironic fiction, Kipling's white man, as an idea, a persona, a style of being, seems to have served many Britishers while they were abroad. The actual color of their skin set them off dramatically and reassuringly from the sea of natives, but for the Britisher who circulated amongst Indians, Africans, or Arabs, there was also the certain knowledge that he belonged to and could draw upon the empirical and spiritual reserves of a long tradition of executive responsibility towards the colored races. It was of this tradition, its glories and difficulties, that Kipling wrote when he celebrated the road taken by white men in the colonies. Now this is the road that the white men tread when they go to clean a land, iron underfoot and the vine overhead and the deep on either hand. We have trod that road, and a wet and windy road, our chosen star for guide. Oh, well for the world when the white men tread their highway side by side. Cleaning a land is best done by white men in delicate concert with each other, an allusion to the present dangers of European rivalry in the colonies. For failing in the attempt to coordinate policy, Kipling's white men are quite prepared to go to war. Freedom for ourselves and freedom for our sons, and failing freedom, war. Behind the white man's mask of amiable leadership, there is always the express willingness to use force, to kill, and be killed. What dignifies his mission is some sense of intellectual dedication. He is a white man, but not for mere profit, since his chosen star presumably sits far above earthly gain. Certainly, many white men often wondered what it was they fought for on that wet and windy road, and certainly a great number of them must have been puzzled as to how the color of their skins gave them superior ontological status, plus great power, over much of the inhabited world. Yet, in the end, being a white man, for Kipling and for those whose perceptions and rhetoric he influenced, was a self-confirming business. One became a white man because one was a white man. More important, drinking that cup, living that unalterable destiny in the white man's day, left one little time for idle speculation on origins, causes, historical logic. Being a white man was therefore an idea and a reality. It involved a reasoned position towards both the white and the non-white worlds. It meant, in the colonies, speaking in a certain way, behaving according to a code of regulations, and even feeling certain things and not others. It meant specific judgments, evaluations, gestures. It was a form of authority before which non-whites, and even whites themselves, were expected to bend. In the institutional forms it took, colonial governments, consular corps, commercial establishments, it was an agency for the expression, diffusion, and implementation of policy towards the world, and within this agency, although a certain personal latitude was allowed, the impersonal communal idea of being a white man ruled. Being a white man, in short, was a very concrete manner of being in the world, a way of taking hold of reality, language, and thought. It made a specific style possible. Kipling himself could not merely have happened. The same is true of his white man. Such ideas and their authors emerge out of complex historical and cultural circumstances, at least two of which have much in common with the history of Orientalism in the 19th century. One of them is the culturally sanctioned habit of deploying large generalizations by which reality is divided into various collectives, languages, races, types, colors, mentalities, each category being not so much a neutral designation as an evaluative interpretation. Underlying these categories is the rigidly binomial opposition of ours and theirs, with the former always encroaching upon the latter, even to the point of making theirs exclusively a function of ours. This opposition was reinforced not only by anthropology, linguistics, and history, but also, of course, by the Darwinian theses on survival and natural selection, and, no less decisive, by the rhetoric of high cultural humanism. What gave writers like Renan and Arnold the right to generalities about race was the official character of their formed cultural literacy. Our values were, let us say, liberal, humane, correct. They were supported by the tradition of belles lettres, informed scholarship, rational inquiry. As Europeans and white men, we shared in them every time their virtues were extolled. Nevertheless, the human partnerships formed by reiterated cultural values excluded as much as they included. For every idea about our art spoken for by Arnold, Ruskin, Mill, Newman, Carlyle, Renan, Gobineau, or Comte, another link in the chain binding us together was formed, while another outsider was banished. Even if this is always the result of such rhetoric, wherever and whenever it occurs, we must remember that for 19th century Europe, an imposing edifice of learning and culture was built, so to speak, in the face of actual outsiders, the colonies, the poor, the delinquent, whose role in the culture was to give definition to what they were constitutionally unsuited for. The other circumstance common to the creation of the white man and Orientalism is the field commanded by each, as well as the sense that such a field entails peculiar modes, even rituals, of behavior, learning, and possession. Only an Occidental could speak of Orientals, for example, just as it was the white man who could designate and name the coloreds, or non-whites. Every statement made by Orientalists or white men, who were usually interchangeable, conveyed a sense of the irreducible distance separating white from colored, or occidental from oriental. Moreover, behind each statement there resonated the tradition of experience, learning, and education that kept the oriental colored to his position of object studied by the occidental white, instead of vice versa. Where one was in a position of power, as Cromer was, for example, the Oriental belonged to the system of rule whose principle was simply to make sure that no Oriental was ever allowed to be independent and rule himself. The premise there was that since the Orientals were ignorant of self-government, they had better be kept that way for their own good. Since the white man, like the Orientalist, lived very close to the line of tension keeping the coloreds at bay, he felt it incumbent on him readily to define and redefine the domain he surveyed. Passages of narrative description regularly alternate with passages of re-articulated definition and judgment that disrupt the narrative. This is a characteristic style of the writing produced by Oriental experts who operated using Kipling's white man as a mask. Here is T.E. Lawrence writing to V.W. Richards in 1918. The Arab appealed to my imagination. It is the old, old civilization which has refined itself clear of household gods and half the trappings which ours hastens to assume. The gospel of bareness in materials is a good one, and it involves apparently a sort of moral bareness, too. They think for the moment, and endeavor to slip through life without turning corners or climbing hills. In part, it is a mental and moral fatigue, a race trained out, and to avoid difficulties they have to jettison so much that we think honorable and grave, and yet without in any way sharing their point of view, I think I can understand it enough to look at myself and other foreigners from their direction, and without condemning it. I know I am a stranger to them, and always will be, but I cannot believe them worse, any more than I could change to their ways. A similar perspective, however different the subject under discussion may seem to be, is found in these remarks by Gertrude Bell. How many thousand years this state of things has lasted, namely that Arabs live in a state of war. Those who shall read the earliest records of the inner desert will tell us, for it goes back to the first of them, but in all the centuries the Arab has bought no wisdom from experience. He is never safe, and yet he behaves as though security were his daily bread. To which, as a gloss, we should add her further observation, this time about life in Damascus. I begin to see dimly what the civilization of a great eastern city means, how they live, what they think, and I have got on to terms with them. I believe the fact of my being English is a great help. We have gone up in the world since 5 years ago. The difference is very marked. I think it is due to the success of our government in Egypt to a great extent. The defeat of Russia stands for a great deal, and my impression is that the vigorous policy of Lord Curzon in the Persian Gulf and on the India frontier stands for a great deal more. No one who does not know the East can realize how it all hangs together. It is scarcely an exaggeration to say that if the English mission had been turned back from the gates of Kabul, the English tourist would be frowned upon in the streets of Damascus. In such statements as these, we note immediately that the Arab, or Arabs, have an aura of apartness, definiteness, and collective self-consistency such as to wipe out any traces of individual Arabs with narratable life histories. What appealed to Lawrence's imagination was the clarity of the Arab, both as an image and as a supposed philosophy, or attitude, towards life. In both cases, what Lawrence fastens on is the Arab as if seen from the cleansing perspective of one not an Arab, and one for whom such unself-conscious primitive simplicity as the Arab possesses is something defined by the observer, in this case, the white man. Yet Arab refinement, which in its essentials corresponds to Yeats's visions of Byzantium, where Flames that no faggot feeds, flint nor steel has lit, nor storm disturbs. Flames begotten of flame, where blood-begotten spirits come, and all complexities of fury leave. Is associated with Arab perdurability, as if the Arab had not been subject to the ordinary processes of history. Paradoxically, the Arab seems to Lawrence to have exhausted himself in his very temporal persistence. The enormous age of Arab civilization has thus served to refine the Arab down to his quintessential attributes and to tire him out morally in the process. What we are left with is Bell's Arab, centuries of experience and no wisdom. As a collective entity, then, the Arab accumulates no existential or even semantical thickness. He remains the same, except for the exhausting refinements mentioned by Lawrence, from one end to the other of the records of the inner desert. We are to assume that if an Arab feels joy, if he is sad at the death of his child or parent, if he has a sense of the injustices of political tyranny, then those experiences are necessarily subordinate to the sheer, unadorned, and persistent fact of being an Arab. The primitiveness of such a state exists simultaneously on at least two levels. One, in the definition, which is reductive, and two, according to Lawrence and Bell, in reality. This absolute coincidence was itself no simple coincidence. For one, it could only have been made from the outside by virtue of a vocabulary and epistemological instruments designed both to get to the heart of things and to avoid the distractions of accident, circumstance, or experience. For another, the coincidence was a fact uniquely the result of method, tradition, and politics all working together. Each, in a sense, obliterated the distinctions between the type, the Oriental, the Semite, the Arab, the Orient, and ordinary human reality. Yeats's uncontrollable mystery on the bestial floor in which all human beings live. The scholarly investigator took a type marked Oriental for the same thing as any individual Oriental he might encounter. Years of tradition had encrusted discourse about such matters as the Semitic or Oriental spirit with some legitimacy, and political good sense taught, in Bell's marvelous phrase, that in the East, it all hangs together. Primitiveness, therefore, inhered in the Orient, was the Orient, an idea to which anyone dealing with or writing about the Orient had to return, as if to a touchstone outlasting time or experience. There is an excellent way of understanding all this as it applied to the white agents, experts, and advisors for the Orient. What mattered to Lawrence and Bell was that their references to Arabs or Orientals belonged to a recognizable and authoritative convention of formulation, one that was able to subordinate detail to it. But from where, more particularly, did the Arab, the Semite, or the Oriental come? We have remarked how, during the 19th century, in such writers as Renan, Lane, Flaubert, Gossin de Perceval, Marx, and Lamartine, a generalization about the Orient drew its power from the presumed representativeness of everything Oriental. Each particle of the Orient told of its Orientalness, so much so that the attribute of being Oriental overrode any countervailing instance. An Oriental man was first an Oriental and only second a man. Such radical typing was naturally reinforced by sciences, or discourses as I prefer to call them, that took a backward and downward direction towards the species category, which was supposed also to be an ontogenetic explanation for every member of the species. Thus, within broad, semi-popular designations such as Oriental, there were some more scientifically valid distinctions being made. Most of these were based principally on language types, for example, Semitic, Dravidic, Hamitic, but they were quickly able to acquire anthropological, psychological, biological, and cultural evidence in their support. Renan's Semitic, as an instance, was a linguistic generalization which in Renan's hands could add to itself all sorts of parallel ideas from anatomy, history, anthropology, and even geology. Semitic could then be employed not only as a simple description or designation, it could be applied to any complex of historical and political events in order to pare them down to a nucleus both antecedent to and inherent in them. Semitic, therefore, was a trans-temporal, trans-individual category, purporting to predict every discrete act of Semitic behavior on the basis of some pre-existing Semitic essence, and aiming as well to interpret all aspects of human life and activity in terms of some common Semitic element. The peculiar hold on late 19th century liberal European culture of such relatively punitive ideas will seem mysterious unless it is remembered that the appeal of sciences like linguistics, anthropology, and biology was that they were empirical and by no means speculative or idealistic. Renan's Semitic, like Bopp's Indo-European, was a constructed object, it is true, but it was considered logical and inevitable as a protoform, given the scientifically apprehendable and empirically analyzable data of specific Semitic languages. Thus, in trying to formulate a prototypical and primitive linguistic type, as well as a cultural, psychological, and historical one, there was also an attempt to define a primary human potential, out of which completely specific instances of behavior uniformly derived. Now, this attempt would have been impossible had it not also been believed, in classical empiricist terms, that mind and body were interdependent realities, both determined originally by a given set of geographical, biological, and quasi-historical conditions. From this set, which was not available to the native for discovery or introspection, there was no subsequent escape. The antiquarian bias of Orientalists was supported by these empiricist ideas. In all their studies of classical Islam, Buddhism, or Zoroastrianism, they felt themselves, as George Eliot's Dr. Casaubon confesses, to be acting like the ghost of an ancient, wandering about the world and trying mentally to construct it as it used to be, in spite of ruin and confusing changes. Were these theses about linguistic, civilizational, and finally racial characteristics merely one side of an academic debate amongst European scientists and scholars, we might dismiss them as furnishing material for an unimportant closet drama. The point is, however, that both the terms of the debate and the debate itself had very wide circulation. In late 19th century culture, as Lionel Trilling has said, racial theory, stimulated by a rising nationalism and a spreading imperialism, supported by an incomplete and mal-assimilated science, was almost undisputed. Race theory, ideas about primitive origins and primitive classifications, modern decadence, the progress of civilization, the destiny of the white or Aryan races, the need for colonial territories, all these were elements in the peculiar amalgam of science, politics, and culture, whose drift, almost without exception, was always to raise Europe or a European race to dominion over non-European portions of mankind. There was general agreement, too, that, according to a strangely transformed variety of Darwinism sanctioned by Darwin himself, the modern Orientals were degraded remnants of a former greatness. The ancient or classical civilizations of the Orient were perceivable through the disorders of present decadence, but only, A, because a white specialist with highly refined scientific techniques could do the sifting and reconstructing, and B, because a vocabulary of sweeping generalities, the Semites, the Aryans, the Orientals, referred not to a set of fictions, but rather to a whole array of seemingly objective and agreed-upon distinctions. Thus, a remark about what Orientals were and were not capable of was supported by biological truths, such as those spelled out in P. Charles Michel's A Biological View of Our Foreign Policy, 1896, in Thomas Henry Huxley's The Struggle for Existence in Human Society, 1888, Benjamin Kidd's Social Evolution, 1894, John B. Crozier's History of Intellectual Development on the Lines of Modern Evolution, 1897-1901, and Charles Harvey's The Biology of British Politics, 1904. It was assumed that if languages were as distinct from each other as the linguists said they were, then too the language users, their minds, cultures, potentials, and even their bodies were different in similar ways. And these distinctions had the force of ontological, empirical truth behind them, together with the convincing demonstration of such truth in studies of origins, development, character, and destiny. The point to be emphasized is that this truth about the distinctive differences between races, civilizations, and languages was, or pretended to be, radical and ineradicable. It went to the bottom of things. It asserted that there was no escape from origins and the types these origins enabled. It set the real boundaries between human beings on which races, nations, and civilizations were constructed. It forced vision away from common as well as plural human realities like joy, suffering, political organization, forcing attention instead in the downward and backward direction of immutable origins. A scientist could no more escape such origins in his research than an Oriental could escape the Semites, or the Arabs, or the Indians from which his present reality, debased, colonized, backward, excluded him, except for the white researcher's didactic presentation. The profession of specialized research conferred unique privileges. We recall that Lane could appear to be an Oriental and yet retain his scholarly detachment. The Orientals he studied became, in fact, his Orientals, for he saw them not only as actual people, but as monumentalized objects in his account of them. This double perspective encouraged a sort of structured irony. On the one hand, there was a collection of people living in the present. On the other hand, these people, as the subject of study, became the Egyptians, the Muslims, or the Orientals. Only the scholar could see and manipulate the discrepancy between the two levels. The tendency of the former was always towards greater variety, yet this variety was always being restrained, compressed downwards and backwards to the radical terminal of the generality. Every modern, native instance of behavior became an effusion to be sent back to the original terminal, which was strengthened in the process. This kind of dispatching was precisely the discipline of Orientalism. Lane's ability to deal with the Egyptians as present beings and as validations of sui generis labels was a function both of Orientalist discipline and of generally held views about the near-Oriental Muslim or Semite. In no people more than in the Oriental Semites was it possible to see the present and the origin together. The Jews and the Muslims, as subjects of Orientalist study, were readily understandable in view of their primitive origins. This was, and to a certain extent still is, the cornerstone of modern Orientalism. Renan had called the Semites an instance of arrested development, and functionally speaking, this came to mean that for the Orientalist, no modern Semite, however much he may have believed himself to be modern, could ever outdistance the organizing claims on him of his origins. This functional rule worked on the temporal and spatial levels together. No Semite advanced in time beyond the development of a classical period. No Semite could ever shake loose the pastoral, desert environment of his tent and tribe. Every manifestation of actual Semitic life could be, and ought to be, referred back to the primitive explanatory category of the Semitic. The executive power of such a system of reference, by which each discrete instance of real behavior could be reduced, down and back, to a small number of explanatory, original categories, was considerable by the end of the 19th century. In Orientalism, it was the equivalent of bureaucracy in public administration. The department was more useful than the individual file, and certainly the human being was significant principally as the occasion for a file. We must imagine the Orientalist at work in the role of a clerk, putting together a very wide assortment of files in a large cabinet marked the Semites. Aided by recent discoveries in comparative and primitive anthropology, a scholar like William Robertson Smith could group together the inhabitants of the Near Orient and write on their kinship and marriage customs, on the form and content of their religious practice. The power of Smith's work is its plainly radical demythologizing of the Semites. The nominal barriers presented to the world by Islam or Judaism are swept aside. Smith uses Semitic philology, mythology, and Orientalist scholarship to construct a hypothetical picture of the development of the social systems consistent with all the Arabian facts. If this picture succeeds in revealing the antecedent and still influential roots of monotheism in totemism or animal worship, then the scholar has been successful. And this, Smith says, despite the fact that our Mohammedan sources draw a veil as far as they can over all details of the old heathenism. Smith's work on the Semites covered such areas as theology, literature, and history. It was done with a full awareness of work done by Orientalists. See, for instance, Smith's savage attack in 1887 on Renan's Histoire du Peuple d'Israël, and more important, was intended as an aid to the understanding of the modern Semites. For Smith, I think, was a crucial link in the intellectual chain connecting the white man as expert to the modern Orient. None of the encapsulated wisdom delivered as Oriental expertise by Lawrence, Hogarth, Bell, and the others would have been possible without Smith. And even Smith, the antiquarian scholar, would not have had half the authority without his additional and direct experience of the Arabian facts. It was the combination in Smith of the grasp of primitive categories with the ability to see general truths behind the empirical vagaries of contemporary Oriental behavior that gave weight to his writing. Moreover, it was this special combination that adumbrated the style of expertise upon which Lawrence, Bell, and Philby built their reputation. Like Burton and Charles Doughty before him, Smith voyaged in the Hejaz between 1880 and 1881. Arabia has been an especially privileged place for the Orientalist, not only because Muslims treat Islam as Arabia's genius loci, but also because the Hejaz appears historically as barren and retarded as it is geographically. The Arabian Desert is thus considered to be a locale about which one can make statements regarding the past in exactly the same form and with the same content that one makes them regarding the present. In the Hejaz, you can speak about Muslims, modern Islam, and primitive Islam without bothering to make distinctions. To this vocabulary devoid of historical grounding, Smith was able to bring the cachet of additional authority provided by his Semitic studies. What we hear in his comments is the standpoint of a scholar commanding all the antecedents for Islam, the Arabs, and Arabia. Hence, it is characteristic of Mohammedanism that all national feeling assumes a religious aspect, inasmuch as the whole polity and social forms of a Muslim country are clothed in a religious dress. But it would be a mistake to suppose that genuine religious feeling is at the bottom of everything that justifies itself by taking a religious shape. The prejudices of the Arab have their roots in a conservatism which lies deeper than his belief in Islam. It is, indeed, a great fault of the religion of the Prophet that it lends itself so easily to the prejudices of the race among whom it was first promulgated, and that it has taken under its protection so many barbarous and obsolete ideas, which even Muhammad must have seen to have no religious worth, but which he carried over into his system in order to facilitate the propagation of his reformed doctrines. Yet many of the prejudices which seem to us most distinctively Muhammadan have no basis in the Quran. The us in the last sentence of this amazing piece of logic defines the white man's vantage point explicitly. This allows us to say in the first sentence that all political and social life are clothed in religious dress. Islam can thus be characterized as totalitarian. Then to say in the second that religion is only a cover used by Muslims. In other words, all Muslims are hypocrites, essentially. In the third sentence, the claim is made that Islam, even while laying hold upon the Arabs' faith, has not really reformed the Arabs' basic pre-Islamic conservatism. Nor is this all. For if Islam was successful as a religion, it was because it fecklessly allowed these authentic Arab prejudices to creep in. For such a tactic, now we see that it was a tactic on Islam's behalf, we must blame Muhammad, who was, after all, a ruthless crypto-Jesuit. But all this is more or less wiped out in the last sentence, when Smith assures us that everything he has said about Islam is invalid, since the quintessential aspects of Islam known to the West are not Muhammadan after all. The principles of identity and non-contradiction clearly do not bind the Orientalist. What overrides them is Orientalist expertise, which is based on an irrefutable collective verity entirely within the Orientalist's philosophical and rhetorical grasp. Smith is able, without the slightest trepidation, to speak about the jejun, practical and constitutionally irreligious habit of the Arabic mind, Islam as a system of organized hypocrisy, the impossibility of feeling any respect for Muslim devotion, in which formalism and vain repetition are reduced to a system. His attacks on Islam are not relativist, for it is clear to him that Europe's and Christianity's superiority is actual, not imagined. At bottom, Smith's vision of the world is binary, as is evident in such passages as the following. The Arabian traveler is quite different from ourselves. The labor of moving from place to place is a mere nuisance to him. He has no enjoyment in effort, as we do, and grumbles at hunger or fatigue with all his might, as we do not. You will never persuade the Oriental that when you get off your camel, you can have any other wish than immediately to squat on a rug and take your rest, istereh, smoking and drinking. Moreover, the Arab is little impressed by scenery. But we are. We are this, they are that. Which Arab, which Islam, when, how, according to what tests? These appear to be distinctions irrelevant to Smith's scrutiny of and experience in the Hejaz. The crucial point is that everything one can know or learn about Semites and Orientals receives immediate corroboration, not merely in the archives, but directly on the ground. Out of such a coercive framework, by which a modern colored man is chained irrevocably to the general truths formulated about his prototypical linguistic, anthropological, and doctrinal forebears by a white European scholar, the work of the great 20th century Oriental experts in England and France derived. To this framework, these experts also brought their private mythology and obsessions, which in writers like Doughty and Lawrence have been studied with considerable energy. Each, Wilfred Scawen Blunt, Doughty, Lawrence, Bell, Hogarth, Philby, Sykes, Storrs, believed his vision of things oriental was individual, self-created out of some intensely personal encounter with the Orient, Islam, or the Arabs. Each expressed general contempt for official knowledge held about the East. The sun made me an Arab, Doughty wrote in Arabia Deserta, but never warped me to Orientalism. Yet, in the final analysis, they all, except Blunt, expressed the traditional Western hostility to and fear of the Orient. Their views refined and gave a personal twist to the academic style of modern Orientalism, with its repertoire of grand generalizations, tendentious science from which there was no appeal, reductive formulae. Doughty, again, on the same page as his sneer at Orientalism, the Semites are like to a man sitting in a cloaca to the eyes and whose brows touch heaven. They acted, they promised, they recommended public policy on the basis of such generalizations, and, by a remarkable irony, they acquired the identity of white Orientals in their natal cultures, even as, in the instances of Doughty, Lawrence, Hogarth, and Bell, their professional involvement with the East, like Smith's, did not prevent them from despising it thoroughly. The main issue for them was preserving the Orient and Islam under the control of the white man. A new dialectic emerges out of this project. What is required of the Oriental expert is no longer simply understanding. Now, the Orient must be made to perform. Its power must be enlisted on the side of our values, civilization, interests, goals. Knowledge of the Orient is directly translated into activity, and the results give rise to new currents of thought and action in the Orient. But these, in turn, will require from the white man a new assertion of control, this time not as the author of a scholarly work on the Orient, but as the maker of contemporary history, of the Orient as urgent actuality, which, because he began it, only the expert can understand adequately. The Orientalist has now become a figure of Oriental history, indistinguishable from it, its shaper, its characteristic sign for the West. Here is the dialectic in brief. Some Englishmen, of whom Kitchener was chief, believed that a rebellion of Arabs against Turks would enable England, while fighting Germany, simultaneously to defeat her ally Turkey. Their knowledge of the nature and power and country of the Arabic-speaking peoples made them think that the issue of such a rebellion would be happy, and indicated its character and method. So they allowed it to begin, having obtained formal assurances of help for it from the British government. Yet, nonetheless, the rebellion of the Sharif of Mecca came to most as a surprise, and found the Allies unready. It aroused mixed feelings and made strong friends and enemies, amid whose clashing jealousies its affairs began to miscarry. This is Lawrence's own synopsis of Chapter 1 of the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. The knowledge of some Englishmen authors a movement in the Orient whose affairs create a mixed progeny. The ambiguities, the half-imagined, tragic-comic results of this new, revived Orient become the subject of expert writing, a new form of Orientalist discourse that presents a vision of the contemporary Orient not as narrative, but as all complexity, problematics, betrayed hope, with the white Orientalist author as its prophetic, articulate definition. The defeat of narrative by vision, which is true even in so patently story-like a work as The Seven Pillars, is something we have already encountered in Lane's Modern Egyptians. A conflict between a holistic view of the Orient, description, monumental record, and a narrative of events in the Orient is a conflict on several levels, involving several different issues. As the conflict is frequently renewed in the discourse of Orientalism, it is worthwhile analyzing it here briefly. The Orientalist surveys the Orient from above, with the aim of getting hold of the whole sprawling panorama before him: culture, religion, mind, history, society. To do this, he must see every detail through the device of a set of reductive categories: the Semites, the Muslim mind, the Orient, and so forth.